This program was produced by Now You Know Media. Lectures are about 25 minutes in length and are designed to fit conveniently into your daily routine while commuting, exercising, or at home. We search the world for trusted expert presenters, record them in our studios, and deliver their knowledge to you whenever and wherever you desire. We invite you to visit our website, nowyouknowmedia.com, to explore our newest programs. This program is entitled Spirituality, Psychology, and Virtue, A Catholic's Guide to a Flourishing Life. Your presenter is Father John Cicero, a Jesuit priest and clinical psychologist, an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Fordham University. He is also rector of the Jesuit community and director of the Center for Spirituality and Mental Health at Fordham. Father Cicero maintains a research interest in personality assessment and the role of spirituality in mental health. He published Praying Through Life Traps, A Psycho-Spiritual Approach to Freedom by Resurrection Press in 2002. Father Cicero maintains a part-time clinical practice in which he sees individuals and couples for outpatient psychotherapy.
Topic 1, From Healing to Wholeness, Practicing a Spirituality of Flourishing. This is an exciting time in the field of psychology, and especially in its approach to spirituality, because a paradigm shift has been happening with respect to an understanding of disease and health, and especially the role of spirituality in fostering wholeness. Historically, psychology has followed a medical model with respect to illness, seeing disease as the absence of disability, so that the goal of psychological intervention was to restore the individual as much as possible to what has been called a premorbid state of functioning, with as few symptoms as possible. Meanwhile, other psychological approaches, more in the humanistic or existential tradition, have focused on what has been called a salutogenic approach, emphasizing that health is the presence of positive states of human capacities and functioning in thinking, feeling, and behavior, even in the midst of anxiety and suffering. This salutogenic approach will be elaborated upon in this talk in the context of the new movement of positive psychology. Corey Keyes, a psychologist at Emory University, has elaborated upon a complete model of mental health that is a combination of the pathogenic and salutogenic. He notes that in the United States, as well as in other industrialized nations, we have undergone an epidemiological transition in the 20th century, where we have experienced an increased life expectancy by some 30 years. But at the same time, there has been a rise in a host of health-related problems, a threefold increase in teen suicide, more adults with anxiety and depression, and more lifestyle and stress-related chronic physical health conditions. Keyes concludes, and I quote, "Increased life expectancy has increased the number of years spent living with chronic physical diseases and mental disorders rather than greater health, and that continued attempts to improve population health solely by disease and illness prevention have proven extremely costly and largely ineffective." Now, in the field of mental health, this paradigm shift toward positive psychology, or flourishing, which has been defined as optimal functioning, where the goal of mental health is not simply to promote the absence of illness or symptoms, but rather the presence of something positive in one's life. For example, a person might recover from clinical depression, where they might experience a reduction in sadness, more energy, and a return to normal functioning, but still not be flourishing. They might still hold on to anger or resentment, for example. In this case, the person might be said to be healed, but not whole. What is this something positive in flourishing? Researchers have identified three broad domains of flourishing. One, the presence of positive emotions, calm, peaceful, satisfaction with life. Two, positive psychological functioning, self-acceptance, purpose in life, positive relations with others. Three, positive social functioning, a sense of belonging and interest in others. An interesting question arises: can a person flourish while still experiencing emotional illness? The example of the saints, more recently the case of Mother Teresa, who reported years of depression, would not for 1 minute take away the very reality that she was indeed flourishing. According to a model that only sees that mental illness is on the opposite spectrum from health, this of course would not be possible. Either one would be free from depression and healthy, or depressed and unhealthy. However, when looking at a flourishing model, one sees that there are many other variables that account for flourishing besides the absence of mental illness. Positive psychology talks about the presence of character strengths and virtues as the tools for promoting flourishing. Researchers such as Seligman and Peterson have identified 24 such virtues. I will focus in this talk on 4 of these virtues: creativity, love, humility, and gratitude. Creativity falls along a spectrum with, of course, the Nobel laureates and great innovative minds representing one extreme, and those who never come up with an original idea on the other end of the spectrum. Most of us, however, function in the area of what might be called everyday creativity. This is the ability to generate creative solutions to the problems encountered at home and at work, perhaps not winning any special awards or recognition. The correlates of everyday creativity are an interest in a wide array of topics. A person who reads, for example, magazines in an area that are not his or her own particular area of interest. An openness to new experience and a willingness to take risks. How do we foster everyday creativity in our lives? First, it's important to defer judgment about the quality of our work, particularly in its initial stages. Any one of us who has begun a new project and has tried to make sure that every detail in the beginning is absolutely perfect soon realizes that the task will never be accomplished, and they need to let go of that perfectionism and obsessionality in order to let the project flow. Secondly, it's important to stop our ordinary work for a while to permit ideas to percolate, to take, as it were, fascination breaks, to permit creativity. A second virtue is love. Now, there are at least 3 types of love. One, which is akin to a child's love for a parent, where we rely on another to make our own welfare a priority, to make us feel safe. A second type of love is similar to a parent's love for a child, where we comfort and protect another, making sacrifices for their benefit to make them feel safe. And a third type of love is like romantic love, where we have passionate desire for sexual, physical, and emotional closeness with an individual whom we consider special and who makes us feel special. Those of us who experience love along any or all of these dimensions report fewer psychosomatic symptoms in response to stress, a greater likelihood of seeking support when we are distressed, are more likely to compromise rather than turning to destructive strategies, and higher self-esteem. Love is really good for us. But what fosters love? Seeking multiple sources of intimacy rooted in the love of God. Pedro Arrupe, who was the previous superior general of the Society of Jesus, once wrote eloquently on love. And I quote, "Nothing is more practical than finding God, that is, than falling in love in a quite absolute, final way. What you are in love with, what seizes your imagination, will affect everything. It will decide what will get you out of bed in the morning, what you will do with your evenings, how you spend your weekend, what you read, what you know, what breaks your heart, and what amazes you with joy and gratitude. Fall in love, stay in love, and it will decide everything." End quote. The third virtue is humility. Now, humility is an accurate sense of one's abilities and achievements, not an underestimated sense of self, a false sense of humility, as it were, nor, of course, either an overestimated sense of self, an inflated sense of self. The correlates of humility are, of course, a willingness to forgive others, and I will be saying more about this later in the course. Humility promotes self-esteem regulation, especially when we are in situations of threat or criticism. When someone criticizes us or when disappointments come our way, rather than falling apart, a person with humility is able to repair and rebound. Humility also renders one less inclined to self-soothe through impulsive behaviors like substance abuse or eating disorders. This is why, of course, humility is the cornerstone of 12-step programs. Humility is rooted in a secure attachment to Christ, being loved as I am, warts and all. Gratitude, the fourth of the virtues. Gratitude may be defined as an enduring thankfulness that is sustained across situations and over time, where life is perceived more as a gift than as a burden. Gratitude has been associated with positive emotions, life satisfaction, vitality, and optimism. Gratitude always restores us to sanity. How do we enhance gratitude? St. Ignatius proposed a spiritual exercise called the Examen, where we look back through our day, each day, and try to identify the specific ways that God has labored in the day to take care of us, to challenge us, to love us, to forgive us, to recreate us. And this is one particular exercise that is especially useful in sustaining gratitude. Now, what is yet to be explored in how spirituality can enhance flourishing? I suggest that spirituality provides a context and a motivation for fostering virtues. More recent work in spirituality and spiritual development has focused around the idea of spiritual transformation and its implications for wholeness or flourishing in the face of illness. Ken Pargament defines stages of spirituality that precede transformation, including a discovery stage where one's image of God develops, and this is usually a mirror image of one's parent, through a conservation stage in early development, through prayer and ordinary daily spiritual experience that sustain my sense of God and the sacred, leading up to the stage of spiritual transformation, which usually occurs in the wake of some significant developmental transition or trauma or illness, where conversion or change occurs in the place of the sacred in my life. For example, seeing God less from a self-centered perspective and more from a God-centered perspective. Or the character of the sacred may change, where an omnipotent God image is transformed to a God image who is much closer to our human experience of suffering, from a distant God to a loving God. Spiritual transformation includes dramatic changes in our world and self-views, purpose in life, religious beliefs, attitudes, and behavior. One scriptural paradigm for spiritual transformation may be found in the Gospel in Matthew 9, verse 31, the story of the woman with a hemorrhage, where the woman is told by Jesus, "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you whole." The word whole, sothesomai, is not just physical healing from the hemorrhage, but also a new view of herself and of God, a new way of being and behaving, from hiding with her illness. Recall, she was reluctant to approach Jesus to touch the hem of his garment. From there to coming forth, announcing herself, as it were, coming forth with confidence and faith. Now, this shift in identity that characterizes spiritual transformation has been described by William May in his book, The Patient's Ordeal. May describes how illness often occasions a certain negative shift in one's identity, in the relationship of ourselves to our own body, where we may experience fear or mistrust of our own body, in the relationship of ourselves to others. For example, illness frequently occasions a heightened dependence upon others, and sometimes resentment that comes along with that dependence, and a shift in one's understanding and relationship to the transcendent, often anger and resentment. How could God let this happen to me? Spiritual transformation emphasizes living in the present with a heightened sense of grace at each moment. For example, when a person is trying to reconstruct their own personal story to enhance their sense of personal identity, flourishing, the promotion of spiritual transformation, helps the person not just to get over or cope with the illness, but to get stronger, holier, more creative, and loving. In psychology, the use of narrative therapy is frequently employed, where the person is encouraged to write his or her own story, emphasizing their heroic choices in the face of trauma. The spiritual approach enhances this psychological therapy by focusing on grace, that is, the ongoing work of Christ, who is laboring with us in and through the period of crisis. During a time of crisis, these negative appraisals or attributions that are frequently made, God is punishing me, or I deserve this illness or abuse, need transformation. Negative religious coping is toxic for us. The work of Pargamon has indicated that people who do see in their illness or crisis the hand of the devil or the punishment of God actually fare worse than if they had no religious belief at all. Instead, what enhances spiritual transformation is a sense that God is collaborating with me, is right there with me at every step of the way as I try to cope with the illness or the crisis. And thirdly, spiritual transformation is enhanced by the exercise of forgiveness. Forgiveness, loosening the chains that bind us. Jack Kornfeld in 2002 wrote a book called The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace. And he wrote, "Without forgiveness, life would be unbearable. Without forgiveness, our lives are chained, forced to carry the sufferings of the past and repeat them without release." Now, forgiveness is not forgetting. It's not necessarily reconciliation. But forgiveness is a decision to reduce negative thoughts, affect, and behavior, and to begin to gain a better understanding of the offense and the offender. Warren Brown wrote an article a few years ago called Physicalism, Suffering, and Disability. And in that article, he made a very important point. Thus far in this talk, I have been emphasizing the role of spiritual transformation for the individual who is coping with suffering or distress or disability. Brown writes about the need for the family, the friend, the support group, the caregivers, all to undergo a transformation. That is, spiritual transformation is not simply the application of the psychological and spiritual approaches that I have described to the sick person, but it is an embodied transformation of all those who are involved. A shift, as it were, in self-identity and sense of dependence that calls forth creativity, humility, love in new and perhaps unexpected ways.